I'm Patricia Lull, and I'm your convener, three-ring circus master, and host for a conversation that's going to go on this afternoon. I want to welcome all of you. Good long day, these wonderful sunny days with fresh air. Thank you for coming inside. I know I recognize a good number of you, almost all of you, from my time in the village, but from the Monday session. But if you weren't here on Monday, that's fine. Dive in today. And let me say a couple of things about this second session on Wednesday. It's not the same thing three times over. We're moving somewhere. And in fact, you said to me, remind me of your name.
Tori.
Tori said to me on Monday, I think I see what you're up to. Good, I'm up to something. And I will say a few things even at the beginning today, because I know that some of you are leaving before Friday, or you may make another choice by Friday at 4 of what you're going to be doing, so that you can see how this, the readings, our conversation, the questions put before you are meant to actually lead you toward some of your own soul work. Now, we have finally entered a busy room, because orientation was going on. I don't know about those guests that arrived. Didn't it seem like they needed more orientation than the rest of us? I'm suspecting somebody jumped off the dock when they landed at Lucerne or something, because they were in here a long time. And what we're going to do this afternoon is a little bit of a shift. By 4 o'clock, we're going to wind up right around 4. And Jason DeRose is going to take over the space, commandeer this very space, but he's a very polite member of the teaching faculty, and if you want to slip out, there'll be a little time for you to do that, but we're going to use the same room the whole afternoon for both of those back-to-back sessions. So we won't go quite until 4:15. We'll pick up again on Friday. We're talking in our time together about a couple of concepts. One is vocation. And we're going to come back at that again today. But vocation in a time of resistance, in a time when many people feel a need to push against something in the status quo, whether it's a push against certain expectations in the corporate world. I've met a number of people up here who made a life choice to switch what they were doing. And that's why they're at a year or two spending it at Holden, so they made that switch. It may also be for you, as it is for many people in our country right now, a pushing against certain things in our public life, and particularly the tone, as well as the direction of our public life. So not just vocation in general, but what does it mean for each of us to think about that in a time of resistance? I know a number of you are going to leave before Friday, so let me put, I want to give you some things to think about. These are questions we're going to end with today that will lead us into Friday's session. Your own soul work, whether you do it here at Holden or on the boat, back down the lake, or do it at home, is, my question for you is, in spite of all, what are we to do with our lives? I think you've sensed, if you were here on Monday, it's not an option simply to be idle or to be in despair for very long or to be perpetually cynical. So figuring out together what we're going to do with our lives, but then also a question that we'll address more directly on Friday. Can religious faith make a difference in a world divided by religious loyalties? Some would argue that religion's at the heart of a lot of the global tensions going on. I'm going to make a little more nuanced argument about that on Friday. So if you don't come back, at least take the questions with you. And if you don't have those paper packets, Sharon's going to come back downstairs and interrupt us and get those passed out. I see, and I don't know if they're specific to this course, but all around here are evaluations, and if you're that kind of person who likes to give feedback, pick up one of those, and I think they get returned to the, just as you enter the dining hall, there's a place to return theirs, or leave them here, and I'll see that Sharon picks them up. But if you join me in prayer, I've borrowed a prayer from the biblical theologian Walter Brueggemann. Walter Brueggemann has for decades paid attention to power that's gone awry when the places of power become idolatrous in our regard of them, when we become idolatrous in regarding whether it's a corporate structure, a political life, a particular nation, a military might, all of which have their right bounds and reasons, but when it explodes beyond that, Brueggemann's been one of the wisest persons to lead us to scripture to understand why we need to pull back from that kind of idolatry. So if you join me in prayer, this is one called The Threats Do Not Wane. Let us pray. The threats do not wane. The dangers are not imagined. The power to undo is on the loose, and in the midst you speak your word. It is your word that cuts the threat, that siphons off the danger, that tames the powers. You speak, and all is made new. You speak your true self of abiding faithfulness, of durable presence, of long-standing reliability. You give yourself in the utterance of fear not, and we do not fear. We do not fear because you are with us and so safe, with us and so free, with us and so joyous. Amen. I think you know that the response amen means not only thank goodness something came to an end, but it means so be it. And so be it that we do have that sense of safety and joy because of God's promises to us. The first part of our time this afternoon, we're going to do one quick toe dip back into some work we did on Monday, but we may not linger there. And then we're going to come again to thinking about vocation, and then a couple of other detours that I want to take with you today. On Monday, we looked at three examples of vocation in a time of resistance, three passages from Scripture. We looked at Matthew, the tax collector. We looked at Jonah, the international ambassador, and we looked at Jeremiah, the land investor, speculator. He bought it up on an unimaginable time. He purchased some land. And I'm wondering if there's somebody here who could give a very quick summary of what the deal was with Matthew, the tax collector. We're not going to read the passage. It's in the packet. But anybody remember what Matthew was about? And what resistance might have been in that story?
He gave up a really good job.
Yeah, he gave up a really good job. And what was that comfortable job he was ensconced in?
Tax collector.
He was a tax collector. And in Israel, in the time of Jesus, that was a lucrative government, civil service position to have. He wasn't much appreciated by his Jewish friends and family for playing that role, but he gave it up. And what caused him to give up that position?
Jesus told him to follow him.
Yeah, and I would say that's a great example where the resistance is personal. You have to weigh it, consequences for your family, but also that compelling call from Jesus to come and follow. Now Jonah, a couple of you are big fans of Jonah. What was his resistance? Because God said, clear as could be to him, Jonah, I have an assignment for you, and Jonah basically said, no way, no how. How's the Jonah story begin? Who can do that? One of you can do that.
God tells Jonah to go to Nineveh and prophesy.
Yep, and why is that a point of resistance for Jonah?
He doesn't want to go.
Yeah, it's an alien empire. He knows it's going to be futile. He doesn't want to take on that kind of assignment, and it's a great four chapters of Jonah dealing with what appears to be something he should resist in a public realm. And he's largely right. I had a great conversation with one of you, with Martin, about, in a sense, Jonah knows what's coming, and he's right about it, and then a lot of other things happen. How about Jeremiah? It's the third story we looked at with that unlikely land purchase of a garden right in the middle of Jerusalem as the invading armies were right at the walls of the city. What was that story about? Who can describe it?
Well,
please.
Jeremiah was told to buy a piece of land mm-hmm. in the city that was about to be overtaken and to take the documents and put them in a jar and save them for posterity.
And why might Jeremiah have resisted that? And it was an invitation. God was at work in that. The prophet Jeremiah was aware of that. But it also, the ask, please buy this property, came from a relative, came from his cousin. Why might there be resistance in that kind of circumstance? I mentioned Flint. I mentioned Detroit. Anybody want to buy some land I have for sale in either one of those cities? Wouldn't we say today, that's not a good investment? By the logic of how we think, what's a wise investment? Here's Jeremiah being asked to do something that goes against everything he's been about as a prophet, which is really to say disaster and exile are on the horizon, and then suddenly he's buying land as though he's going to return someday and have that little garden. That little garden plot in the midst of the city. So another story of a time of resistance. You may have already gotten to these readings, or you have them in the packet, and you can get to them later. I want to spend just a few minutes with Joan Chittister, because she's a great voice on really tough issues, and then another person named Nora Tubbs Tisdale. So if you like to follow along, find your readings. One's called God's Work. The one we're going to start with, God's Work is Our Gift to the Future. Can anybody introduce Joan Chittister to us? Maybe you've actually heard her speak, or you've read some of her books, or you can just read the bio at the end of the article. Who knows who Joan Chittister is? I hear some murmuring up in the front. Who's Joan Chittister? Heard the name, okay, that's a start. Please.
The Benedictine order, so.
Yep, she's a Benedictine. The Mount St. Benedict in Erie, Pennsylvania is the order house she belongs to. She is, here's my best description of Joan Chittister. She is a force to be reckoned with. I've heard her speak a couple of times. She takes no captives. She tells the truth boldly with just a flood of religious women, sisters, nuns, right behind her. So she speaks a voice from within the Catholic Church, often as a critic of the Catholic Church, but just talking about the social order, the time in which we live. But she's always been a great reflector also on vocation and what it means to have a call from God. And in this particular very short essay, she says something that I think will resonate with all of you, because she's not the first person to have said it. She said we face three decisions vocationally. The first one comes early in life. What am I to do with my life? Those of you who were here on Monday, we talked about what did you want to be when you were 8, and then 18, and then 23, and then maybe again at 30. Early on in life, what am I to do with my life? Something that can also be an early in life question, but she really says it's a great midlife question. Who am I really? And then a third question that we hope, if we live in a healthy way, we get to face, how do I wish to live out my retirement or my elder years? And some of you are here because you're at that first phase. What am I called to do? You're doing kind of discernment. Others of you at a kind of midpoint in life are rethinking that, taking another look, thinking about who am I really. And some of us are here because we're cresting the hill, not as though life were over, but one more chance to say, what am I going to be about? And to feel some freedom in retirement or in one's elder years to do some things differently than maybe the way we did them earlier in life. And Joan also, in this essay and in other writings, says it's natural to keep coming back to these questions. So if that's part of what has brought you this afternoon or brought you to Holden, good for you for knowing that these are ways that we live out our faith and wrestle at different times. There's a great quote, those of you who have the document, on page 52. She talks, this is over in the right-hand column. She talks about what's going on in the United States. This was written a couple of years ago. But she talks about small communities that are connected to other small communities and are a real place of hope. And you'll read in that right-hand column on page 52, a website that she has started called Monasteries of the Heart. And I didn't check it out. You know, now we're at Holden where we can't check out websites. But when I get home, I'm going to actually check out that website and really commend it to you. And a way of encouraging people not to feel isolated, but to keep multiplying, to keep networking those small communities, if it's two people, if it's 20, so that we build a wider base for hope in the midst of crisis. Any of you here feel that you're in a community like that? Could this be ground zero? Kind of Holden experience? I think some would say Holden's that kind of community that's a beacon for things we do back home. It renews us. It helps us meet new people to stay encouraged. But anybody else have an example about a small community, a local community you're a part of that you think is a beacon for hope? Like, please.
Indivisible groups are meeting and they're connecting with other areas.
I think that's a national movement, isn't it?
Yeah, but they're focused in little communities that then connect. Like we were, Gal was with Bonnie Lake on something recently in Tacoma. So those groups are meeting individually but connecting beyond themselves.
And I think, as I understand it, at least from my Minnesota experience, it's a way of saying, in a democracy, as we have in America, if you don't like how some elections have gone, get organized, because it's a public, equal opportunity thing to engage in local politics and show up and get out the vote. And it might, I think it has some other ramifications, but that's a national network, but the local is the real focus. Anybody else think of a community that's giving you some hope, a small local community? Please.
My husband and I are part of a martial art where we have a dojo. Mm-hmm. We are connected to other sister dojos internationally, and we often have seminars together where it's a little like Holden, where we get together and we practice together. And we may diverge in small things, I'll call them the details, but then you come back together to renew like what it is that's a part of what you're doing.
Beautiful example, because I think there would have been a time in my life that I would not have thought of martial arts. I would not have thought of sports teams as ways that people connect locally that are linked together and always with a purpose. Martial arts are always about something, some core values there. So thank you for that example. Anybody else, please?
Yeah. Aid Northwest is advocates for immigrants in detention.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a big detention center called ICE down in Tacoma. And that's immigration and enforcement. And anyway, we have some orientation. We go in and visit people in there who want visits, and that's a wonderful connection.
And I think probably networked with other groups all over the country. And for our generation, we have a lot of digital media that allows us to be connected, even if we never meet one another face to face, to draw encouragement, technique, support from one another. Sharon, people are going to raise their hand, and you'll get good papers to them. And as you get papers, I'm going to make a shift now to the essay that some of you had a chance to look at by Nora Tubbs Tisdale. Bonus points if anybody's ever heard of this author. Has anyone ever heard her speak or have a sense of where she's located? Her essay is called Job and Vocation, Discerning the Difference. I think the hands are all just for papers. I looked her up. She teaches at Yale Divinity School. Teaches homiletics. But obviously is a person who teaches practical theology, the sort of how we live out our faith. And in this particular essay, the topic she's taken on is vocation. If you now have your paper in front of you, take a look on page 8. As I said on Monday, there was a time when many, many of us would have equated job with vocation, career, the definer of life. We are now living some very, very positive reasons, not just economic changes, but very positive reasons, living in a time where we think more broadly about all of our relationships as the place where our vocation gets expressed. And I think in this particular essay, Nora does such a fine job of lifting up not everyone, the principle that everyone has a vocation, even if job is not the main place that that shines through, or just to hear somebody's job title might be a limiting way that would not touch the really expansiveness of what you're about. For some of you, I think a few of you here are on short-term, long-term staff at Holden. I could imagine back home, if you said, I read some of the job titles on the board looking at your pictures earlier today. If you said that back home, do we have any Mavericks here? Or Garbology? Where some of you are working at Holden, what are your job titles here?
I work in Narnia.
Yeah. So if you say, I work at Narnia, yeah, right, okay. Anybody else here on staff?
Laundry.
Laundry, yeah. If you say, I'm in the laundry, I'm working at Narnia, people are going to, But we know, because we are the beneficiaries of your presence in the community, you are about something so much larger than Narnia, laundry. It's part of something larger. And I think it's a really helpful thing for all of us to hear about job and vocation, and not equating the two or collapsing the two together. You'll see if you're on page 8, I'm going to ask somebody to read that first paragraph under the heading, A Clarifying Voice. Would somebody be able to read that for us? Please, thank you.
A clarifying voice. To me, one of the great gifts of the Christian life can be summed up this way. No matter where we find ourselves, we have a vocation that has been given to us by God and confirmed for us in our baptisms. We are called to be disciples of Jesus Christ. And because that vocation is God-given, there is nothing this world with all of its injustice, unfairness, and inequality can do to take it away.
Wow. And I think even beyond those who are baptized, persons who live out of their deepest core values, no matter what descriptions others would put on their life, there's something powerful every day they wake to live out and to express. And the whole notion of vocation, theologically, is one that says this kind of core. It's about more than just, we need people to do different kind of jobs. You take your turn, your lot in life, hope you have fun. We say no, the call to be a person of faith, and for me as a Christian, to be a baptized Christian, is to say that's the deepest reality of who I am, and I'm going to live it out in a variety of ways and work. I thought about this yesterday in the dish room in that just brief stint, but I was thinking as I scrubbed pans, just a couple of years ago, I was out of work, and I worked part-time for an Asian restaurant, and I was no less me working for the Asian restaurant. I was on the road, they had some catering sites and setting up the food and serving people. They had no idea who I was in a broader sense, but I hope they felt that in my service to them, that a real person had shown up to serve them their lunch or their dinner. What I want to do, because your stories are every bit as fascinating as mine, is take what I call a neighbor break, where we're going to pause for 5 minutes, and you're going to talk to somebody next to you or behind you about your own sense of vocation today. Okay? And you can move chairs around a little bit if that helps. And I'll call us back together in about 5 minutes. So what's your own? Tell somebody near you. What's opening up in you about your own sense of vocation? Okay, you're having too much fun. You gotta come back together. I hope you were talking with somebody you didn't know perfectly well, and you might continue that another time. We end up in the food lines together and at tables together and at vespers together. Energy, I don't know what you were saying, but it sounded like you had hit on things you wanted to share with one another. Quick story from my time working for the Asian restaurant. One of their contracts was with a community college that had many satellite campuses, often in office complexes. And one of my jobs was to pick up food in those big carriers, drive to one of the satellite campuses, back into the loading dock, a skill I did not have, but now can do a whole lot better than when I started. Load the food, take it up in the freight elevator, get it set up, and there was just a small window of opportunity between classes to sell the food and to get everything set up and to get those little flames going to keep everything at the right temperature and get all the condiments set out and do all this. And one day at the restaurant, this is run by a couple of very, very small restaurant in the neighborhood where I live. They were running late, so I left the restaurant late, get to the site, have to back into the dock, have to get a push cart to take all these big containers on. And I know I'm running late. And again, if you miss the break between classes, you sell no food because people are there to study. They're working people, and it was evening and a little time to sell food. And so there were a couple of other programs also in the building. One was an employment program, and they provided the custodial staff for this whole complex. And a man named Herbert helped me. It wasn't really his job to do, and probably if his supervisor had seen him doing this, wouldn't have been so good for him. But he helped me get everything into the freight elevator and up to the right floor, and even helped me light the little containers to get all the food set up and ready to go in time for the class break. And when we had everything, when we were coming out of the freight elevator, Herbert, who was in this employment program because he had just come out of prison, that's what the employment program was, to give people some life skills so they could get a job. Herbert said to me, "Don't worry, I've got you back." And I saw vocation all over that. I was a pastor with a lot of years of experience. Herbert had my back. So I've tried to make talking about vocation more my entree point when I meet people rather than simply what do you do, what are you about, or what are you up to, or what are you interested in. You'll discover, we'll all discover amazing things in the people around us. So I'm going to guess that you've got the concept of vocation down. And now I want to make another move, because we need to come up with a way to think in larger categories than just my vocation, your vocation. And one of the best models, and there may be more contemporary ones, I was surprised when I saw how dated this one was, but is to think about Christ and culture. There's a classic book, H. Richard Niebuhr, and this is the correct spelling. I'm the one who's not the great typist. If you have that cover sheet for this, that's how you actually spell his name. I typed it wrong. H. Richard Niebuhr gave some lectures in 1949, and then by 51, a wise publisher had gotten him to turn it into a book called Christ and Culture. Don't buy it new. You can find it in a used bookstore for about 58 cents. Or maybe if you belong to a congregation, it's in your church library. They won't miss it because it's a dated book. But in the late 40s, early 50s, was taking seriously social science. And what social scientists, demographers, anthropologists had to say about different ways that Christian communities are organized. And before we're done, I'm going to raise a question about how Muslim communities today are organized. I think it's a grid that can translate across some different religious identities. What do we know about religion in America in the 1950s? If that had been a topic that you had come to Holden to talk about, what do you think might have been put on the menu for discussion of American religion in the 50s? What was it about?
Catholics versus Protestants.
Yep, still a big issue, Catholic versus Protestant, at least by my reckoning, that remains an issue. Some places remains an issue even today. The election of John Kennedy in the early 60s is a big game changer there. Can Protestants vote for a Catholic? Will the Pope be running America? All kinds of prejudicial things. You go back and read some articles from the early 60s about that. So Roman Catholics and Protestants. What do you know? When we say Protestants, who were the big deal churches?
Lutherans,
but kind of onto themselves still in the 50s. We knew we were a big deal if we were Lutheran. Other people hadn't quite noticed us because we weren't always so friendly in speaking the language of others. We sometimes say mainstream, mainline Protestantism, the Presbyterians, the Episcopalians, the Methodists, and in some quarters, the Baptists. How about the evangelicals in 1950? What if I had invited you to a presentation on the evangelical movement in America in 1950?
Who are they?
Sure. Exactly. That's going to be a movement coming later. Now we never think about public life and religion without thinking of the evangelicals, but there was a time that they were here, but they weren't who we were paying attention to. How about the Pentecostal movement? It was here, but that wasn't going to be on the cover of Time magazine. That wasn't going to be in the mainstream of what was being discussed. For Protestant churches, it was time of prosperity. I'm a bishop in the St. Paul Area Synod, and I have the privilege of walking through a lot of the buildings built for congregations in the 50s and the 60s. And now because of some church mergers, they're four blocks away from another building that was built in the 50s or the 60s. For the same now Lutheran church body. Suburbs were growing, and it looked like we were on just the right course if Christians were meant to, our kind of Christians were meant to be in control. That was the 50s. Some other reflections on that period.
It seemed to be a fulfillment of what had begun with the beginning of the century, the Christian century.
Yes. Think of the magazine. I'm so grateful it's gone into yet another century, but the Christian century and sort of a world, it's post-World War II, we're thinking it's going to be not only more prosperous, but more peaceful. We can look back now and see that to some degree prosperity was there, but not the peace in the way that we would hope for. And it's at this time that Niebuhr, drawing on some sociologists before him, comes up with the grid or the chart that's in your packet. What I want to say, and this is Niebuhr's own disclaimer, no one person or faith tradition ever conforms perfectly to a type. So that's the little caveat. It's just a tool. Just a tool. So let's take a look at that. And to introduce that, I want to share a quick story from my time just a little over a week ago in Tanzania. On the 25th of June, a new bishop was consecrated in the regional city of Iringa, which is in the southern highlands of Tanzania. Tanzania is about 40% Muslim, 40% Christian, 20% traditional forms of indigenous faith. And the Muslims and the Christians, for the most part, get along quite well. It was a remarkable experience to be staying in the Lutheran Center, a guest house originally built for pastors, Tanzanian pastors, when they needed to come into the headquarters, and to hear right over the back fence the call to prayer from the local masjid, and to also see the big celebrations, Eid, at the end of Ramadan there in Tanzania. But on this celebratory day, 6,000 people gathered in an open field where some tents had been set up for the consecration of the new bishop. The morning began with all the pastors of the diocese meeting about 3/4 of a mile away at the Lutheran Cathedral and processing down the street, which had all been closed in this very commercial city, because it was a big day for the Lutherans. And so on came the procession, marching bands and the police escort, and 200 of their pastors were able to be in there from the countryside and all processing, and then bishops galore. I'd tell you more about that, but it would embarrass me if I tell you how I was dolled up on that day to process with the other bishops. But there we gathered, and in the course of that outdoor 6-hour service, I heard 2 very remarkable speeches. So, same platform, same day, same event. At one point, a couple of hours in, retiring Bishop Odenberg M. de Gala spoke. We all paused, thinking, how long will he speak? Because he was known for speaking a long time. And we were only a couple of hours in, so we figured he felt he had time. But he praised the regional government. He said we could not have built the university, which had been built on his watch, University of Iringa, first private university in Tanzania, it's a Lutheran university, without the cooperation of the government. He invited forward members of parliament. 7 of them came out into the center and sang for us and danced for us. That took another 45 minutes. And they were there were a lot of great choirs, but I will say that having members of parliament, they really were extraordinary singers, and the excitement and the crowd, the whole festivity. And a little bit later, sometime later, he also invited, while the president had been unable to come, the president of Tanzania, his regional deputy came and gave a speech. It was in Swahili. And my 2 translators, the presiding bishop of the Lutheran Church in Tanzania and another bishop who had been talking to me on either side, don't favor the current president, so I received no translation. I have no idea what the person said. But before the morning and now afternoon was over, the presiding bishop for the Lutheran Church in Tanzania, and I had been seated next to Frederick Shu. He had just a quarter sheet of paper in which he had written some notes. I had seen it in his hands, and he had written a few throughout the 6 hours. He went to speak, and this was translated for me by a companion bishop who was there. He decried the cooperation and collusion between the government and those who were most wealthy, who were profiting from ravishing the natural resources. Okay, all the same day. He criticized the heavy tax burden and what that was doing not only to churches and institutions, but individual families. And then he called on the 7.6 million Lutherans in Tanzania to pull together to address these injustices. I heard it all in the same service, same day. And those are very different views of faith and culture, Christ and culture. We're going to take a look at the chart. And I want to say, friends, I may have gotten it wrong. If some of you are students of Niebuhr or you find that book on the shelf and you dig in, I did a kind of quick overview of the 5 categories. If you take a look, if you have that sheet before you. Again, remembering it's a tool, it may in fact be a helpful tool for some of the work we're going to do today and then again on Friday. Let's take a look at Christ against culture, and I'm about 3 lines down, the basic premise. Faith against culture would say faith requires an either-or response. You're either going to be a person of faith or you're going to be a part of the empire. Person of faith, part of the empire. So that's one extreme view. How are faith, how is Christ in particular related to culture? Well, not at all. You need to choose. Which way are you going to go? That would be one position. Now I'm going to go to the right, the Christ of culture. Christ's teachings are the highest human achievement, And this would be a lot of that thinking in the 1950s about the rise of American Protestantism and the values there, and in a sense where you can't tell whether you're being a good citizen or a good Christian, because Christ, the teachings are really where everybody's trying to get. They may not know it, but they're really trying to become what some other people have been already called into. Middle category, Christ above culture. Christ is superior to culture, but it helps lead a person to Christ. That would be culture leads a person to Christ. You might think of good schools of a religious tradition would help people come to faith.
Patricia?
Yes?
My experience with that, though, is Bible reading. I grew up in a Mormon community.
Sure, that would be, where would you put the Mormons? Right here?
Yeah.
Christ above culture?
That they were trying to lead us into a with school prayer, organized prayer.
And so that I think many of you are going to be able to think of some examples from your own experience, and you would say of the Mormons that middle category. A fourth one, moving to the right, Christ and culture in paradox, and if you've peeked down, this is where Lutherans generally, this is where Martin Marty says we belong. There are two moralities, two authorities, both the civic realm and the religious realm, and they both need to be obeyed. We're in but not of, sort of, you can't abandon the culture, the context in which you're born and currently living, but that isn't the ultimate authority for all things, so back and forth. And then the way over on the right, Christ, the transformer of culture. Christ is able to convert culture so that it aligns with the Christian way of life. I have a lot of friends in the Reformed tradition these days. I went to a Presbyterian college, work in the Twin Cities very closely with both a Reformed church tradition and also the Presbyterians. They would say back in the 1600s, Calvin was about this. Most would not say that's what Presbyterians are about today. But there was a time, Calvin in Geneva, people were willing to let Calvin and others really organize the whole civic life as well as the religious life. So you get, that's another one. Just the whole culture becomes what faith requires. You can see I put some examples down there, and now I want to just throw out a couple of questions for you. Would there be some other examples any of you would add? We've heard one about a Mormon community that would work to shape the values, including within the schools, to sort of build up the culture according to Mormon values and their sense of faith. Anybody else think of an example today? Please.
The Canadian Supreme Court ruled a few years ago that they had historically allowed certain civic matters to be settled within small religious communities, mm-hmm. and most of those religious communities were Quebecois or Native mm-hmm. Canadians. But then, when there was more Muslim communities moving into Canada, and there was a problem of Sharia law, they realized they needed to re-examine all of how to be a good citizen yeah. and so the ruling. Was the essence of the ruling is we're all Canadians first. Canadian law shall be the highest law, and then within that context, if you want to resolve it to a finer degree with amongst yourself, that's okay, but you will not contravene any Canadian law.
So there was a repositioning. Thank you for that example, because in the 21st century, we have many more communities of faith or faith traditions showing up to be part of the conversation, part of the give and take. Anybody else think of an example you'd put somewhere on this chart?
So I'm sort of thinking of something that's apart from these, I think, and that's religious traditions that want to separate themselves entirely and be totally separate from and apart from by creating their own culture and self-contained.
The Amish.
Yeah.
Now, I put them on the left, Christ against culture. Then, in a sense, they would remove themselves. In the medieval period, too, not every monastic community, some were preachers and out in the community, but often that was, monasticism was often a withdrawal. I would say the Amish, and in some periods, the Mennonites. Shakers, communities that would say, you've got to choose, and we're choosing our faith, or faith has chosen us, and this is where we're going to be. In reading Bonhoeffer, I think at the time that he writes discipleship, or some of you may know it as cost of discipleship, he's really moving away from being in the mainstream of impacting what's going on with Nazism, and it's more, this is how those of us called to faith will live, and there's an order for how to live one's day, and life together, and discipleship would be there. I'm not an expert on Islamic State, ISIS, but where would you put them? Somebody shouted out.
Put on the right.
Very much to the right. I talked about John Calvin 500 years ago in Geneva. We've seen this phenomenon before. And you named it sometimes that, oh no, it's going to be Sharia law. If we step back and say, okay, what are we really talking about? But there are, the Islamic State as its own political entity is saying, this is the superior way to organize life, is to be a particular kind of Muslim, and you take over, you get the whole government, you get the whole political network doing that. But they're not the first to have ever done that. Okay, see how a chart might be helpful. Here's why I wanted to give you a chart, and then I'm gonna give you another chance to talk to your neighbors about where you are or where you wish you were on this. Often in our contemporary world, when we can't speak to one another, it's a kind of impasse. Maybe we shout at one another, not very helpful, but that polarization. If faith is an issue, it might also be that people are seeing the relationship of faith and culture differently. Very hard to talk across these categories. We always do much better if people share the same concept of how we should relate in public life. Doesn't mean we can't learn from one another. But if people understand, yes, we're called to be citizens, we're also called to be people of faith, that sense of paradox, Christ in but not of culture, you might have one kind of conversation with some disagreements or agreements, but if you are in a conversation with somebody who says there's nothing good about public life, we must withdraw, and you're selling out because you're still involved in your local community life, you're going to see it's going to be hard to have a conversation. So another 5 minutes to talk to somebody near you about just where your own experiences are, where would you put your mark on this chart? You can also put it up in the margins if you just don't want to commit to one of these candidates, okay? I'll call you back in 5 more minutes.
Can you send me a copy of that chart? I realize it would be very small up here, but it would give us something to look at.
Do you not have copies up there?
We do
not.
Okay, somebody come down. Do we have some extra handouts down here?
I have one set.
Yeah, there, Sharon's good. It's coming up to you. Thank you for calling out on that. Okay, 5 minutes, 4 minutes now to talk. Where's your own mark on that? Thank you for that little interlude, whatever it was you discussed. This session two is our hinge session, and there are a couple of things I want to introduce for the benefit of those who come back on Friday. So it doesn't get all stitched together today. But you now have a tool, and I'd ask you to play with it a little bit. Think about it. Put some of your friends, particularly if you have somebody who totally annoys you, when you try to have a conversation with them, you still claim them as a friend, and maybe they claim you, but you're always like this. Try to think if maybe you actually at the level of how faith and culture, faith and public life come together. Maybe you're just in really different categories and you're going to have to find a better bridge than just coming at each other like this. That's why you have the grid or the chart, and I'm glad it reached upstairs. I want to go on one more detour. Come back on Friday and see if it can all be woven together. And the detour, the other topic I want to introduce, is something I've thought a lot about the last 2 years. And it's about why we're having such a hard time getting beyond the polarity in this country. We're very polarized. We're angry at each other. We're more likely to shout or shut down than to, I want to romanticize those Vermont, those New England town hall meetings. Maybe they weren't so wonderful, but I grew up in the Midwest and we always thought out east maybe people had figured out democracy and the whole community together. But just let that be an illusion for me for a while. But I'm of an age to have remembered the Vietnam era where in a lot of communities of faith, in a lot of town halls, at a lot of Thanksgiving dinner tables, it was very difficult to talk about the war because people were at very different places. So we've had that experience in the past in this country, but we're certainly having it these days. And I, it's not that I like when people shout. In some ways, I might prefer that to people shutting down and not having anything to voice. At least with shouting, if you can tamp it down a bit, maybe something. And one of the books that I found very helpful, and I couldn't find my copy, and I raided a couple of church libraries and I couldn't find it there, so I had to pay good money to buy it afresh. I know I once owned it. But an author named James Dittus, and this is on that cover sheet that came with the packet, just a small book called Bias and the Pious. Bias and the Pious. He set out to study, is it really true that people with religious faith are actually more prejudiced than people without religious faith? And really what he was looking at were white Christians in their attitudes toward African Americans. And this couple of decades old, he didn't study only Lutherans, but friends, we Lutherans were part of the study. Some of you may remember a film that came out in the early 60s, I think called A Time for Burning. It was an in-depth conversation with a congregation outside of St. Louis. They were studied, all the individuals, many agreed members of the congregation agreed to participate in focus groups and surveys and be interviewed, and it was a really in-depth looking at faith tradition that says we're saved by grace, and then what people live out in their daily life. And what Dittus puts forward in this book, and though it's dated, I think that may make it actually a little easier to read. It's very contemporary in the kind of topics it addresses. Dittus's claim, as many others would make, is whatever is dearest to us at the core of our identity, we cling to if we think somebody else is threatening it. Kind of a simple principle. When you feel under threat, you hold tight. And it's that core identity that really gives us our place in the world, our status in the world. All kinds of things feed into that, traditions and people and perceived values and institutions. And when you challenge that, people's own resistance to whatever novel idea you're trying to introduce goes way up. And I will say, I believe a lot of church fights are rooted right there. We joke often in church circles about the fight about the color of the carpet. But if one of your kinfolk had been on the committee that chose the original color, it gets personal. So church fights, neighborhood fights, school board fights, national political elections about whose values are going to prevail are often rooted in how we think about identity. In this book, he talks about a woman named Martha. She's a member of the Lutheran congregation that Dittus has also worked with. And he would describe her as a fairly pleasant person to live next to. In the congregation, she always notices the newcomers, but something happens with Martha when an African-American woman about her same age visits the congregation, and in the kind of socializing time, still in the pews, at the close of worship, as that visitor, African-American woman, comes toward Martha, she turns around and goes out a side door. In talking with her, what Martha says is, well, I wanted to welcome her, but I didn't know what to say, and I didn't want to say the wrong thing, so I walked away. What it meant to the African-American visitor, I think now we would use the language, it's another one of those microaggressions. You're just trying to go to church and be friendly, and somebody's almost, you're about to extend a hand to them, and they turn and walk away. That's what Didis explores in this book. What was it about Martha's experience? And partly is she didn't want to say the wrong thing. She was more concerned about making a mistake, a fumble, in what she would say, feeling a bit awkward in that encounter, not having had a circle of friends who were African-American, not having had other experiences. And I really commend a book like Didis's Bias and the Pious to you, because while you'll find longer books and more thorough books to explain all the dynamics there, Didis comes around in his final chapter to challenge those of us in faith communities to look at how our deep values also can help us move beyond our inclination toward prejudice, toward stereotyping, and as we would say today, just blatant racism, and actually address it. And I think it's the kind of book I would am encouraging congregations in our synod to look at, that or some other tools that are available today.
Would you just tell me the names of those books again?
Bias and the Pious.
Okay.
And the Pious. So identity, prejudice, and how the assets of a faith community, meaning we do have lived practices about how we welcome people. We do have a theology that says, yep, sometimes you say absolutely the wrong thing and you feel really bad about it, and that doesn't need to be the last, that doesn't need to be your exit strategy, but how we help one another move into more open conversations. Identity. So identity is at the core. Martha was defending her identity and what she knew, and then bristled at the thought of being stretched beyond what was familiar. A couple of the first-person essays, biographical essays in the packet are meant to introduce you to some testimony from a black mother, from a Latino, from someone who describes himself as a hillbilly from Kentucky and Ohio. And there's a lot of reading, and I hope in your community, opportunities to get to know people across their deepest identity. That's what I wanted to introduce on this Hinge Day. Now let's get out of here. Give me about 3 minutes to wind up, and then Jason and I are going to switch places. I invite each of you, as you think about vocation and your own identity and your own experiences and what has shaped you, to really pay attention to what's going on inside of you. When do you bristle? When do you feel awkward? When do you feel so annoyed you're almost beyond words? So that with that reflection, what we're going to do on Friday is to say, how might we use deep identity and the fact that people see their faith tradition and the public sphere differently, different categories, as some tools for the work that we each need to do back home. That's going to be my challenge, to see if I can get you to help weave that together in a way that makes it makes sense for you as you go home. For Friday, if you're going to be around, if you'd read anything more in the packet, if you have time and that intrigues you, but also 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, maybe a whole hour, thinking about what your core values are about our public life, about the common good, about how we inhabit our communities with people who share maybe some of our own same values, but have values that aren't really our values. And we're going to see what that means in the public arena in the year 2017. You've been great to plunge in today. Hope you find your way back to the surface, breathe a little bit. And we're going to do that 3-minute exchange right here as Jason comes up and we switch topics. Thank you all.